All right, we're beginning here on the top of Yutet Amud Aleph by the two dots. Tan Rabbanan Umin Migdash Lo Yetze. So we saw in the Mishnah there was a machloket between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda as to what the meaning of Min HaMikdash Lo Yetze. What's the requirement for the Kohen Gadol not to participate in the funeral of a relative? So in the Mishnah, Rabbi Meir says he follows them through the city, but never appearing on the same street. And then he releases them when they get to Shar Ha'ir. Now then, Rabbi Yehuda says that the Kohen Gadol is restricted from leaving the Mikdash altogether. So now the Gemara brings a braita and says, "Mikdash lo yitze, lo yitze imahen, ava yotzehu acharehen." He may not accompany them, but he can go after them. Ketzad, how do you have that, or has that manifest? Hey nichnasim v'hu nigle, hey niglim v'hu nichse. That's exactly what we saw in the Mishnah in the position of Rabbi Meir, that he stays behind them. As they turn the corner, then he appears in that street. And as they clear the next street, then he's able to enter that street. So they're never on the same road together, never the same street together. They're not visible to one another, but he's following after the procession. If you would say, Ad Petach Shar Ha'ir, Gemara says, and it seems simple from the Lashon of the Psukim, which is Shapir Kamar Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda really has a strong position over here, which is that the Pasuk says, Umin HaMikdash Lo Yetze. Sounds like he can't leave the Mikdash at all. And again, if we go back to our paradigm in Parshat Shmini of Aaron there Hashem is explicit that he can't leave the Chatzer Ol Moed during that period of time that he's an Onein and the period of time that he's an Avel. So if you use that as the paradigm, it would seem that you would take the pasuk here literally to say that the Kohen Gadol has to remain in the Mikdash. So Amar Lacha Rabbi Meir, Ihachi Leveito Namilo? So now you're going to tell me that he can't even return to his house, he can't even return home? That seems to be far-fetched or ludicrous that he would have to spend the entire week in the Mikdash and not be able to return home at all. Obviously, when it says in the Mikdash, lo yitze, you can't take that literally, that he can't physically leave it at all. It just means that, eli hachi kamar, min ha-Mikdash lo yitze, mikdushato lo yitze, he has to protect or preserve his kedusha, and therefore, you have to take harchokot, or you have to take precautions, so that he doesn't become tavei. V'kevin dit lehekera, lo ati leminga. And since here we've established a way by which it'll be obvious to him that he's not allowed to become Tamei, because he never appears together with the coffin or with the procession, and he always follows behind them. So given that, he'll know that he can't become Tamei, and that will preserve his Kedusha. Rabbi Yehuda says, Agav Mirrei, because of his bitterness, or that he's overcome by the despondency and being distraught over the death, Dilma Mikrei Va'ati V'Noga, maybe it'll happen, or maybe he'll run, and come into contact with the mate, meaning that he'll rush the procession or rush the coffin because of his tremendous emotions at this time. So from here, and I mentioned this yesterday in the Mishnah, it sounds like that both Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda believe that this din is derabbanan, because they're just speaking about what type of precaution we need to take. And generally when we're taking precautions, that's a din derabbanan. That's what seemingly was the view of Rashi, the Ran, and the Ramban of the Torah takes a similar position, although he says, Min HaMikdash Lo Yetze, it's not really a separate mitzvah, it's just a way to facilitate the ability of the Kohen Gadol to continue to do Avodah, which he is instructed to do, which is while he's an Onein, he still is supposed to be performing Avodah because his Avon is no Nitchalel because of the fact that he is an Onein. On the other hand, the Rambam, as we mentioned yesterday, thinks that it's a Din de Oraita, it's a mitzvah Min HaTorah not to leave the Mikdash. And what you're going to have to say then for the Rambam is that this is similar to Loti Gruvula Galot Erva, where you have a Archoka Midoraita, and it's similar over here. But the other Rishonim believe that the Pasuk is just an Asmachta, although again, you could read that they have a fundamental difference in how they read the Pasuk. Had it not been the way our Gemara lays it over here, the easiest way to read it would be that Rabbi Yehuda reads the Pasuk literally, meaning Mikdash Leitze, and Rabbi Meir reads it as being that he may not leave his Kedusha, not that he may not leave the Mikdash. And he cites as evidence the fact that he is allowed to go home. Although, again, if you look back to our paradigm in Parshat Shmini, it makes it sound there that Aaron and Banav cannot leave the Chatzar HaMoed at all. And it sounds like they did live there for 7 days, and therefore it may not be so far-fetched to think that that might be the case here as well. Okay, now the Gemara continues with Kushu Menachem. When the Kohen Gadol is paying a condolence visit, or really here it's at the gravesite when they're doing the Ma'amad afterwards, and he's consoling the Avel, then we saw in the Mishnah the procedure for that. Tan Rabbanan. So now we have a braita. Kishu over bishura lenachem et acherim. When he is in the shura to go ahead and console others, meaning that someone else is in avel and he's consoling them. Skan umashuach she'avar bimino. Then on accompanying him on his right side, is the Skan, who is basically his chief of staff, his right-hand man. Mishuach Shavar is a Kohen Gadol that filled in for the present Kohen Gadol when he was Tamei or otherwise incapacitated on Yom Kippur. So those two individuals on his right, Verosh Beit Av, and then the head of whichever one of the families was working in the Mikdash that week, he was on the left, the Avelim B'chol Ha'am, and so are the mourners and the remainder of the Am, Mismolo, on his left side. That's the setup, both from perspective of Kavod for the Kohen Gadol, that he has these important individuals on his right and on his left, that he's being accompanied, he's being flanked, as well as the fact, again, we've mentioned before, of creating a certain amount of buffer between him and the Am, and distinguishing him from the Am as a whole. Ukshul made Vishura. On the other hand, if he is the Avel, Umit Nachem Acherim, and others are coming to console him, Skan Mimino, once again, the Skan, the chief of staff, the right-hand man of the Kohen Gadol, is on his right. Rosh Beit Av, V'chol Ha'am Mismalo. And the Rosh Beit Av and the remainder of the people are on his left, meaning those that are consoling him. Aval Mashuach Shavar Lo Atigabe. Absent from this scenario is the Mashuach Shavar. In the first scenario where he's going to console, Mashuach Shavar was on his right side. In this instance, the Mashuach Shavar does not appear here at all. My time up. Why is the reason that the Mashuach Shavar is not allowed to be there or accompany him? Chal Shadate. Because it would cause consternation, or maybe even difficulty for the Kohen Gadol, Sabar Kachadabi, because he's going to think that he's celebrating in the misfortune of the Kohen Gadol. You have to think that the plight or the predicament of the Kohen She'avar is very difficult. He filled in for the Kohen Gadol at one point in time, so he functioned as a Kohen Gadol. That puts him in a predicament whereby after the Kohen Gadol or the original Kohen Gadol returns to service, he is demoted. He can no longer be the Kohen Gadol because there's only one Kohen Gadol. But since we have a principle of Mali Mikdusha of Enu Maridin, therefore he can only be a Kohen Gadol. And that means that he cannot return to being a Kohen Hedyot. So then he's stuck in this limbo state where he's neither a Kohen Gadol nor a Kohen Hedyot. And so the only thing standing between him and the Ketuna Gadolah is the current Kohen Gadol. So the Kohen Gadol who is currently in service has his suspicions about the motives of the Mashuach Shavar. And therefore, in situations or circumstances where the Kohen Gadol is in a difficult situation, like here where he is an Avel and he's lost a close relative, we don't bring in the Mashuach Shavar because the Kohen Gadol might think or feel that he's celebrating in the loss or the difficulty of the Kohen Gadol's plight or predicament, and therefore we avoid having him be there in those situations. Amara Papa, Shmamina Mahamat Nita, Tlat. From this braita that we just read, there are three conclusions you would come to. Shmamina, Hainu Skan, Hainu Mimuneh. That the Skan and the Mimuneh are synonymous. That is because in our braita over here, it says that when the Kohen is going, it says that the Skan is to his right. In our Mishnah, when it described the Kohen going to be Menachem Avel, it described that he had the Mimuneh Mimino. That he had the Mimuneh on his right side. If I then try to compare and contrast the Mishnah to the Braita, I would assume that the Mimuneh, who's on his right side, is also the Skan that is found in the Braita. Now the Bali Tosafot over here say, how do you know that? Because we mentioned two individuals here. We mentioned both the Skan and the Mashuach Shavar. Maybe the Mashuach Shavar is equivalent or equates to the Mimuneh in our Mishnah. And the Tosafot says, V'lekha l'meimar d'hainu Mashuach Shavar, the pshita lo mikre Mimuneh. The Gemara is certain about the fact that he's not called the Mimuneh. And he says that it's also implicit in the Mishnah, or in our Mishnah, that the Mimuneh is there both when the Kohen Gadol goes to be Menachem, as well as when the Kohen Gadol is receiving Nechama. And we know from the Braita that the Mashuach Shavar is not there in that case. And so therefore the only option to equate people or say they're synonymous is between the Mimuneh and the Skan. And that's what the Gemara concludes over here, that the Mimuneh and the Skan are the same individual. So now that's the first thing. Shmamina, Avelim Umdim, V'chol Ha'am Ovrim. So this is what you were asking. It's not similar to our practice today, whereby the individuals who are consoling stand in a Shura, and the Avelim pass in between that Shura. But in their time, it's clear from the Braita, that the Avelim were stationary, V'chol Ha'am Ovrim, and the people who are coming to console pass by. Just the opposite of what we do today, which is that the Avelim stood and the Am passed in front of the Avelim in order to console them. Ushmamina, Avelim the small, Hamenachamim, Eim Nomdim. The other thing that we conclude is that here, when you're speaking about a single line that is going in front of the Avelim, to which side are they when they're walking by the Avel? So from the Braita, it's clear that the Avel is on the left side, based on the description that we saw, that for the Kohen Gadol, to his right is the Skan and the Meshuach Sheavar. To his left is the Rosh Beit Av, the Am, and the Avelim. So you see that the Avelim are towards the left side when you are consoling, and therefore the Shura would be created in a way that the line that was going to console him would keep the Avelim to the left side as they pass by them. Those are the three conclusions you have from the Braita that we just read. In the beginning, the practice was that the Avelim were stationary, and the Am passed by in front of them to console them. There were two important families in Yerushalayim who were in competition with each other. Zotomeret Aniover Tchila. Zotomeret Aniover Tchila. Question as to who gets precedence when it comes to the Shura. We remember this is a very hierarchical society, and where your status in society was important and also dictated in certain situations who went first, who went second. And so you have these two families that are arguing amongst themselves as to who's more important and who should get precedence when it came to Nichum Avelim. Who gets to go first in line? So Hitkinu, they solved the problem. Sheheya am omdim vavilim ovrim. They solved the problem of competition in that way by making the am that stands there static and the avilim to walk by the am. So they reversed the practice in order to solve the problem, which is that they're no longer competing to get in front of the avel, but rather the avel is the one who's doing the movement and going to go in front of them. So you set up the lines, or the shura. Today we have shurot, the two lines. And the Avel walks by the Shura, and they console the Avel as he walks through the lines. That is a change in the practice in order to deal with the issue of competition or the difficulties that might arise from having to choose who goes to console the Avel first. So by flipping the way that we do the Nechama, you no longer have that question or issue. So Amar Rami Barabo, Hegzir Rabbi Yossi at the Davar Yoshno B'tzipori. Rabbi Yossi, who was a Mara D'Atra in the area, was very familiar with the city of Tzipori. Tzipori is a city found in the lower Galil that is actually today still intact, and you can go visit there, and the city is almost intact, or they found it almost intact from the Roman times, and you can see houses, you can see the streets, you can see many features of the city. It's a sprawling area. It's a wonderful visit. You get to see some of the items that are mentioned in the Gemara about Haseba, about the way they set up their dining rooms, and other matters that I mentioned in the Gemara are found in Tzipori. So Rabbi Yossi gave psak halacha, or was paskening for Tzipori. Tzipori happened to be a very wealthy city, and it also flourished after the Churban HaBayit because it did not join the merit, it did not join the rebellion against Rome, and therefore was spared the fate of many of the other large Jewish cities. And that made it into, at one point, the capital of the north, but also a very wealthy and successful city and center of the north. So in Tzipori, Rabbi Yossi dictated that they go back to the old ways. Shu Avelim Omdim V'cholam Ovrim. That the Avelim should be stationary and the people should pass by. He tried to return it to the original practice. V'amar Rami Bar Abba. So an additional item that Rami Bar Abba is telling us, that Hitkin Rabbi Yossi B'Tzipori, Shalote Isham Alechet B'Shuk Ubna Acharea. That women, when they go through the shuk, should not walk through the shuk and have their child or children following behind them. Mishum maaseh shehaya. Because of an incident that took place, Rashi over here tells us that the incident was that a woman was walking through the shuk and her child was behind her. And because the child was behind her, individuals came and kidnapped the child and took the child away. When the woman turned around and saw that her child was missing, she panicked, started to scream, and said, "Where's my child? Where's my child?" Some people who were in collusion with the kidnappers came over and said, "Oh, we know where he is. Let us take you to where he is." And they took her to the house where they had kidnapped the son. And then they were, the way Rashi describes it, me'aneota, whether that means rape or whether that means that they tortured her. But usually the word inui or ane is in a sexual context. And so they took advantage of the woman because she was isolated and came to the house to retrieve her child. And so they were mitakein, that when a woman went through the shuk, that she should keep her children in front of her, under her eye, so that people couldn't kidnap the child. V'amar Rami Bar Abba, Hitkin Rabbi Yossi B'Tzipori, is a third takana that Rabbi Yossi instituted B'Tzipori. Shu nashim misaprot v'beit kisei mishum yichud. that when the women went out to the outhouses in the fields, that they should talk amongst themselves so that you won't have a problem of yichud. That's either because if they weren't speaking and it was quiet, it's a possibility when you have these outhouses in the field that another individual would not know that they were there. And therefore, a male might enter into the Beit HaKisei unbeknownst to him that there's a woman there and end up in a situation of yichud. Or we could worry about the fact that people will use this as a way to meet or consort with individuals. So therefore, if the women are speaking, then they know that the other woman is still there or is not involved with anything else. Or, again, it could be for the protection of the women, that the women, if they're speaking amongst themselves, then they know that the other one is fine or the other one's still there and is not being taken advantage of by someone because she's alone in the outhouse because they're speaking between each other in the fields. Amar Rav Nashir Bar Avat, Shilit et Rabbi Yoshia, Rabo Beit Umin Duhutzal V'Amar Li. Rav Nashir Bar Avat says, I asked the Rabbi Yoshia Rabo, the great Rabbi Yoshia, or the older Rabbi Yoshia, in the cemetery in Hutzal, and he told me, Ein Shura Pchuta Me'Asara Bnei Adam. When you set up a Shura, the minimum requirement of a Shura is 10, is a minyan. Ve'ein Avelim Min HaMinyan. And the Avelim don't count towards the minyan for the Shura. Bencha Avelim Omdim V'Chol Ha'am Ovrim. It doesn't matter which practice you have the minhag to do, which is, doesn't matter if the Avelim are stationary and the Am is going in front of them to console them. Bencha Avelim Ovrim V'Chol Ha'am Omdim. Or whether, like, the practice we have today is where the people are stationary and the Avelim walk by them to be consoled. In either of those situations, you require a minion. And the minion has to be independent or separate from the Avelim. As the Gemara in Dupo notes, that is differentiated or distinct from the case of Sheva Brachot, where you require a minion, but there the Chatan is min haminyan. He is included in the minyan. And obviously over here it would make sense why you would, here you want to console the Avel, and the minion is developed or there to create the consolation independent of the Avel. Whereas by the case of the Chatan, the idea is to celebrate with the Chatan, and therefore the Chatan is counted towards the minion by Sheva Brachot. Ukushu mitnachem, in the Mishnah gave us the verbiage that he uses when they come to b'minachem him, which is that the people say to him, Anu kaparatcha, v'u omer lehen tidbarchu min hashamayim, and he responds to them. So when they come to console him, the Mishnah gives us the statement that he has to make. On the other hand, when it goes the other way, how do we know what he says? What does the Kohen Gadol say when he is going to console another party? That's by Yibailu. Ki minachem hu achrinei heichi amaluhu. When he goes to console others, how does he console them? Tashma. Vu omer titnachamu. And he says to them, you should be consoled. Heichi dami. What's the case that we're speaking about here? Ilei mekimenachamei achrinei lididei. If you're speaking about a case where others are consoling him, amaluhu, he says to them, ihu titnachamu. He's going to say to those parties when they're coming to pay a shiva call to him or to console him, he's going to say to them, tit nachamu, that you should be consoled. That's nachosha karamiluhu. That's as if he's poteach pele satan. It's as if he's wishing upon them that they should become a velim and they will require his consolation. So that seems to be inappropriate. And therefore he concludes, ela ki menachem lachrine amalahu tit nachamu. It's clear that the bright that's being made here, a case where he's going to console others. In that situation, he says, titnachamu, shmamina. That is the conclusion that you have from here. But the question is, what was the havamina of the Gemara? Why would you think that when the others are coming to console him, he would say titnachamu to them? So that might be answered by what we saw in our Mishnah yesterday, which is, for instance, in the Sudat Havara. When it comes to the Sudat Havara, we have the Kohen Gadol sit on the bench, and we had the people sit on the karka as if they were the Avelim. Then in a sense, they take on the Avelut on behalf of the Kohen Gadol. And similarly, we saw that in Parshat Shmini as well with regards to Aron HaKohen, where Moshe tells him that Bnei Yisrael will yivkut esrefa, that they will cry on your behalf. So in a sense, the people become Avelim over the loss that the Kohen Gadol suffers. So that might be the Havamina of the Gemara over here, that the Kohen Gadol speaks to them as Tidnechamu, that you should be consoled. Why would he be consoling them? Because they are acting as the Avel on his behalf. Nevertheless, the Gemara in the end sees that as not being proper etiquette or making sense because it's as if he's wishing ill upon them. And therefore, when we say over here, the Brayta says Tidnachamu, it's a case when the Kohen Gadol is going to console others. Okay, Melech Lo Dan. We saw in the Mishnah that the king does not join a Sanhedrin, nor can he be tried by a Sanhedrin. Amar Rav Yosef, Lo Shanu El Malchei Yisrael. So I noted this yesterday in Rav Yosef's answer about who is the Kohen Gadol going to testify for. Rav Yosef answered for the Melech. So Tosafot asked over there, and we discussed this yesterday, Rav Yosef is of the opinion, you can see that over here, that there's a distinction between Malchei Yisrael and Malchei Beit Yehuda or Malchei Beit David, which is that the Mishnah, when it says that the Melech may not join a Sanhedrin, may not be tried by a Sanhedrin, that's only true by Malchei Yisrael. Aval Malchei Beit David, Dan v'danin otan. They can adjudicate, they can be part of a Sanhedrin, and v'danin otan, and they can also be brought to trial. Dichtiv, because the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu says, Beit David, ko amar Hashem, dino lebokir mishpat. What Hashem expects of Malchut Beit David is that they bring justice and righteousness in the morning. I mean, that's what we expect of Beit David, and that is the hallmark of Beit David, is mishpat, is justice, especially when it says, ko amar Hashem, dino lebokir mishpat, that specifically that the king is charged with this mission of ensuring that there is justice. Vilo dainin lei, and if we don't allow him to be brought to trial, inu hechi dainei, how could they be then judges? Baktiv, we brought this yesterday, the pasuk of it koshushu v'koshu, v'amresh lakish, kshot atzmecha, v'achakak kshot acherim. If you can't be subject to the rules and the law, then you can't be the one who is enforcing the law. And so therefore, if you want the Malchut Beit David to be the ones who are carrying out justice, then it would have to be a situation in which they could be brought to trial, be brought to justice. So that's Rabbi Yosef's position, that only Malchut Beit Yisrael are covered by this din of our Mishnah, but Malchut Beit David are not subject to the rule of the Mishnah. But Vali Tosafot say, didn't we learn yesterday that the Braita said that you may not sit a king in a Beit Din or in a Sanhedrin because of Lotanei Arif, because everybody's going to be afraid to argue or undermine the position of the king. So now, if that's true, that should be true for both Malchut Beit David, as well as Malchut Yisrael, as well as Malchut Beit David. So then, that would suggest that there's a restriction against the Melech Beit David from being in the Sanhedrin. So he says, V'esh lomar d'hocha mayri davka ladun dinei memanot. That what we're speaking over here is in monetary matters. D'lo ichpat lan im lo yochula not acharav. Because in case of monetary matters, we don't worry as to whether people will object or argue on the king. That is true in a regular Beit Din, a regular Sanhedrin, that when it comes to Dinei Nefashot, we start from the youngest or the lowest on the totem pole in terms of their opinion, and then we rise until we reach the head of the Beit Din or the top person in the Beit Din to give his opinion. When it comes to Dinei Memanot, we let the Gadol speak first, because we don't worry about the others being intimidated or not being willing to speak up. So to over here by the Melech. When it comes to Dinei Nefashot, that would be a problem. When it comes to Dinei Memanot, it won't be an issue. And so therefore, the Bayit Tosafot limit our statement over here of Rabbi Yosef to cases of Dinei Memanot. But then, Tosafot is faced with the problem, which is that later on in the Masechta, we find that David HaMelech was a participant in a trial of Morid B'Malchut. Or at least he was sitting there on the side. Which seems to indicate, even in issues of Dinei Nefashot, the Malchut Beit David is allowed to be a part of the Sanhedrin. The Bayit Tosafot in the end answer v'yishlamar kevin she'otu din lichvodo, that the whole case there was a case because of Morid B'Malchut. This was someone who had rebelled against the king, or had reason to believe was treasonous, because referring to Naval, who rejected David's overtures for supplies and for food, and Abigail intercedes to stop David from killing Naval. Over there, the Gemara later on is going to discuss the story that he convened a Beit Din in order to convict Naval of being a Morid B'Malchut. And it says there that David was a participant in that case, or sat there in the Beit Din. So the Bayit Tosafot say that was an exception to the case, because over there, it was about him. Since it was about him, other people would not be embarrassed to speak up. But in a situation when they were trying some third party, then they can have the king as part of the Beit Din, because if he spoke, that nobody else would be willing to contradict the king in that case. So now the Gemara continues and says, Ela Malchei Yisrael, Maitai Malo. Why is there a distinction between Malchei Beit David and Malchei Yisrael? Malchei Beit David, we understand why they are allowed to adjudicate, or why we would want them to be a part of a Beit Din, especially given the psukim that we saw. But why would we then exclude Malchei Beit Yisrael from being judges in cases of being tried. Because there was an incident, like most takanot and gzeirot wrote, the result of an incident. The Avde the Yanai Malka Katal Nafsho. One of the Avadim of the king Yanai killed someone. He was a murderer. And the Beit Din called in the slave to be put on trial for murder. Amarlo Shimon and Shetach Lechachamim, Tnu and Echim Bo, Nidoninu. Let us put our eyes upon him and let's judge him, meaning that let's bring him to trial over the fact that he murdered. Shalkulei Avdach Katal Nafsha. So they sent a message to the king Yanai that your servant killed someone, he murdered someone. Shadrei Lahu. He sent this servant to them. He complied with the subpoena to have the Eved be brought to the court to be tried. Shalkulei Ta'anat Nami Lahocha. Then they sent back to Yanai Melech, you can't just send your servant, you have to be here in person. Because it says, Vehu'ad the Bibalav. When it comes to the monetary possessions of an individual, if the monetary possessions are being put on trial, it has to be done in front of the owner of that item. And that's Vehu'ad Bibalav. So in that case, in the Torah, it's being about a shor, it's being about his animal. But it would be same true of an Eved Kanani, who is also the possession of the king. And therefore, if he's being put on trial for murder, then the owner, the king, must be present in order that we do this in the presence of the owner. So, Amra Torah Yavo Balashor V'yamod Al Shoro. Torah says that the owner of the shor has to be there when the shor is being tried for killing someone. So too, over here, Yanai HaMelech, you must be present with your servant. Ato, he complied again. V'yotiv, he showed up in Beit Din and sat down. Amalei Shimon Bet Shetach. Shimon Shetach seems to be either head of the Beit Din, or the muflah should be baked in. He says, Yanai HaMelech, amod al raglecha. Stand up. V'yayidu b'cha. And that they were able to testify against you. V'lo lefaneinu ata omeid. Don't think that I'm asking you to stand up for our honor, or because I want to demonstrate my power. Elifnei misha amar v'yayulam ata omeid. The requirement for you to stand has nothing to do with the baked in, but has to do with the fact that this is all done in front of Hashem, before Hashem. This is what we spoke about in the introduction to the Masechta, that the terminology of Elohim that is used to describe the Dayanim, which is also the Shem Hashem of Elohim, speaks to the fact that the Shechina is present in the Beit Din, and that God is present in the Beit Din. And God says, V'amdu shnei anashim asher lahem arif, that the two individuals, the litigants that are coming to the case, have to stand up. And so since you are one of the parties here, you're the owner of this Eved Kanani, you must stand up here in the Beit Din. The Balei HaTosafot over here ask a number of questions as to why Shimon ben Shetach insisted that Yanai HaMelech stand up. He says there are a number of ways to get around the problem, including if the Dayanim want the Balei Din to sit down, it's fine. If the Dayanim invite the two litigants to sit down, they can both sit down. If they want them both to stand, they can have them both stand. So now, first of all, over here, there was no other party to the case because it was a case of murder. So it's really the state that is convicting the Eved of Yanai HaMelech. So then why wasn't Yanai HaMelech entitled to sit down? Or why couldn't they have told him to sit down in this case? That's the first question of the Balei Tosafot. The second question of the Balei Tosafot is, that if a Talmud Chacham comes to court, he does not have to stand up. He can sit down. Because of the Kavod HaTorah, because of the Kavod that is owed to the Talmud Chacham, he has a right to override the necessity to stand up in Beit Din, and he may sit down in Beit Din. And we know when it comes to the king, the Kavod of a king is on a much higher level even than a Talmud Chacham. A Talmud Chacham was Mochel HaKavodo, who waives his right to Kavod, it's waived. A king that tries to waive his Kavod, he's not successful at doing that. He's unable to waive his kavod. Melech shemachal kavodo, kavodo enu machul. So you see that it's even a stronger form of kavod. So if we let a Talmud Chacham sit down in a court, why wouldn't we let the king sit down in a court? So Balei Tosafot asks both of these questions as to why Shimon ben Shetach insisted on Yanai HaMelech standing up and not sitting down. So the Balei Tosafot here answer, they give a number of different nuances here that help answer the question. The first of which is, even if the litigants are entitled to sit down, when it comes to the Gemar Din, when it comes to the verdict being read, there the Balei Din, the litigants must stand up at that point in time during the Gemar Din. So even if they have permission to sit during the trial, and again, the only requirement there is that both litigants are treated equally. You don't make one stand and the other one sit, but both sit or they both stand. As long as you treat them equally, it's fine. But as far as the Gemar Din is concerned, there, everybody needs to stand for the Gemar Din. And therefore, even though Yanai HaMelech might have been entitled to sit down, either because of the Kavod HaMelech, or because of the fact that the Batei Dinim can waive the necessity to stand up and they can allow him to sit down. Despite either of those reasons, he still required him to stand up because of the Gemar Din. And Tosafot even says that it's possible that Kabbalat HaEidut has the same status as Gemar Din, and that you have to stand for both of those. And Tosafot says that the Batei Dinim have to be careful about these factors, that by Kabbalat HaEidut and the Gemar Din, that they should have the Balei Din and the Edim stand for those items. So that's one answer, a possible answer to the question as to why he wanted Yanai Melech to stand up. The other possibility is that Yanai Melech or the Melech is distinct from a Talmud Chacham. A Talmud Chacham can waive his Kavod, so he is supposedly on a lower level than the king. But what the Balei Tosafot point out is that's not really true. The reason that the Talmud Chacham can waive his right to Kavod is because the Torah becomes his. At first, the Torah belongs to Hashem, but eventually the Torah becomes his. And since it's his, he can make a decision as to how he treats it or how he deals with it. On the other hand, the Kavod, or the position of the king, is not determined by his personal accomplishments. It has to do with the state of the position, or the stature that we want with the position, or the Kavod of Klal Yisrael. Therefore, the inability of the king to wait his Kavod is not because it's a higher level of Kavod, but rather because it's a different type of Kavod. It's a Kavod that is bestowed upon him from others, and therefore he doesn't have a right to undermine it. Other than in a case like the Talmud Chacham, where he owns his Kavod, then he has a right to waive it. And for that reason, then we would say that even if a Talmud Chacham can sit, maybe a king cannot sit down. Number two is that the Kavod of the Beit Din might be the same thing as the Kavod of a Talmud Chacham. Meaning that the Kavod to stand up in the Beit Din is to give Kavod to Torah and Kavod to God. A Talmud Chacham, as well, the reason to give Kavod to a Talmud Chacham, again, is because of Kavod HaTorah. So over there, it's Kavod HaTorah, Kavod HaTorah, therefore the Talmud Chacham would sit down. On the other hand, by the king, you're dealing with competing types of Kavod. You have Kavod HaTorah of the Beit Din, or Kavod HaLukim. On the other side, you have the Kavod HaMelech. And what we're saying is that the Kavod HaLukim, or the Kavod HaTorah, would trump the Kavod of the Melech. And that's why Shimon Meshechtach felt or wanted to insist that Yanai Melech stand up. That's the reasoning that the Balei Tosafot give. The other possibility is brought by the Meiri, who suggests that the reason Shimon Meshechtach wanted Yanai Melech to stand up is because Yanai Melech took a seat on his own. He sat himself down. Now, it's one thing if the Beit Din gives you permission to sit down, then you can sit down. What you can't do is preemptively sit down in anticipation of the fact that the Beit Din is going to let you sit down. You have to wait for instructions from the Beit Din. And that's why Shimon Meshechtach was upset about it. And therefore he insisted that he stand up. Because until Beit Din gives him permission, he may not sit down. The Ran then brings another reason, which is very interesting. He says that Shimon Meshechtach here made a mistake. Or he did not need to insist on Yanai Melech standing up. But he made a mistake in his demand that Yanai Melech stand up. It's a very difficult answer in the Ran. Both from a fundamental standpoint, that Shimon Meshechtach was the mufla of the Beit Din would make such a mistake, but more importantly, from the continuation of the story, it doesn't seem to make so much sense that there was a mistake here, but rather it seems to be that Shimon Meshechtach was right, and Hashem comes to his defense. The other thing that at least needs to be addressed, and is not clear here, is that we know from the Gemara in Brachot that Shimon Meshechtach is Yanai HaMelech's brother-in-law. If he's his brother-in-law, then he's disqualified from being a judge in a case, because of the fact that he is a relative. So either you're going to have to say here that they weren't relatives at this time, which seems very unlikely, or that Shimon Meshechtach wasn't one of the judges in the case, but rather the Mufla Shem Beit Din. He was the most important person in the Beit Din. He was the head of the Beit Din, but he wasn't one of the judges in the case. He had recused himself, or he was never one of the cases. He just worked as the Mufla Shem Beit Din in order to overcome this problem of the fact that they are brothers-in-law. So then Yanai HaMelech says back to Shimon Meshechtach, I'm happy to listen to you, but I want to hear what the remainder of the judges say here. Says, I'm alone. Lo kishite amer ata. I'm not going to abide by what you say, Shimon Meshechtach. Ela kamash yomru chaverecha. I'm going to listen to whatever the remaining judges in the case are going to say. Nifnali mino. He looked to his right. Kavshu b'neim bakarka. They all stuck their heads in the sand. They refused to address Yanai HaMelech. Shimon Meshechtach looks to his right for support from the other judges in the case. All of them stick their head in the ground as if they're not going to respond to Shimon Meshechtach or uphold the position. Nifnei l'smolo, he then turns to his left. Bikavshu b'neim bakarka, again they stuck their heads in the ground. They refused to respond to Shimon Meshechtach. They were too scared of Yanai HaMelech, and therefore they refused to give psak against Yanai HaMelech. Amalem Shimon Meshechtach, balei machshavot atem. you guys are all compromised over here. You are not willing to stand up for what's right and for the kavod of Hashem. Yavo bal machshavot v'yiparei mikem. The one who is the bal machshavot, meaning God, who is the one who gives all machshavot, he should come and take retribution from you. Miad ba Gabriel v'chabatan b'karka. Right away, Gabriel shows up and pushes them all into the ground. Mida k'neged mida, they stuck their heads in the ground. So he puts them into the ground. Umeitu, and they all died. Bota sha'a amru, melech lo dan, velo danin oto. When it comes to a king, he can't be a member of the judiciary, as well as the fact that he cannot be brought to trial. Lo me'it, velo me'din oto. And he cannot testify, and he cannot be testified against. So that was the derivative of this story of Shimon ben Shetach and Ya'anai HaMelech. And again, this conclusion of the Gemara is what makes the answer of the Ran, that it was a mistake here, seem very unlikely because of the fact that Shimon ben Shetach at the end kills all the other judges that were with him. Now, it is also very possible that Shimon ben Shetach was the only Prushi on the court, and that the other judges were all Tzdukim. Because in that time period, it was very common for the Tzdukim both to be members of the Kuna, or leading members of the Kuna, as well as to be the judges in these situations. And over here we're speaking about obviously a very high level Beit Din, because they were able to subpoena Ya'anai to come down, and he acquiesced and he did show up. And we see many cases in that time period that the Tzdukim were in charge. And so it might have been a almost double victory for Shimon ben Shetach in this situation, because he both stood up for the Kavod HaTorah and the Kavod of Hashem in the face of the pressure from Ya'anai HaMelech. But he also then ridded himself of all these Tzdukim that were packing the Beit Din and maybe were indebted to Ya'anai HaMelech for their appointment or for some other reason, and therefore they were unwilling to demand of Ya'anai HaMelech that he stand up in this situation. All right, the Gemara says, Lo chaleitz v'lo chotzim. When it comes to the wife of the Melech, if he passes away, you don't do chalitza with his wife. And also, if his brother passes away, the Melech does not do chalitza with his brother's wife or with the Vama. So as Rashi explains over here, we explained it on the Mishnah already, the problem is that it's beneath his dignity to do such a thing. And as Rashi explains here, chalitza gnai huilo, chalitza, or performing chalitza is something that's denigrating to him, because he has to come to Beit Din, v'tehei rokeket lefanav, and then she has to spit in front of him, which would be inappropriate for the king. V'yibom gnai huilo lakum ha'shem achiv. And yibom is also a denigration because of the fact that he's now going to be doing something for his brother and not for himself. That now somehow the king is subordinated to the needs of his brother, that seems to be inconsistent with the position of the melech. And therefore we don't allow him to perform chalitza or have chalitza done with his wife. In all likelihood, the reason that we don't do chalitza with his wife is because we saw before in the Mishnah that when the king passes away, his wives may not remarry. Since his wives can't remarry, they can't have yibum. If you can't have yibum, then you don't need chalitza, because we know that those are two sides of the same coin, which is chalitza and yibum come together as a package. And so if you can't perform yibum with his wife, then you also don't need chalitza in that case. And so now the Gemara says, Ini, is it really true that you don't perform chalitza? V'amar Rav Ashi, afilu mandamar nasi, simachal al kvodo kvodo machol. A nasi who wants to waive his right to honor, he has a right to do so. Melech simachal al kvodo ain't kvodo machol. A king who's mochel in his kavod has no rights to waive the necessity to treat him properly and to treat him like a king. Shneamar, som tasim alecha melech, that you have to place or appoint upon you a king. Shedei emato alecha, that the fear of the king must be upon you. That's the case, then we understand why there is no chalitza performed on the wife of the melech, as well as why the melech won't perform chalitza on his brother's wife. Because that's all beneath his standing or his dignity. And then the Gemara wants to question further, didn't we have Rabbi Yehuda over there said that if he wants to do the mitzvah of Yibum, if he wants to do the mitzvah of Chalitza, Zachor Latov, he should go ahead, we bless him to do it. So Ini is a question of Rabbi Yehuda, which is, don't you have the requirement of Eimato Te'alecha, that you have to have the fear of the king upon you? And so therefore, even if the king wants to lower his kavod and perform the mitzvah, there's still a demand from his position to hold on to his kavod or to remain in the position of a melech. So he can't lower himself to do a mitzvah and waive his kavod or somehow undermine the office of the king, which requires emato te'alecha. The Gemara answers, mitzvah shiny. When it comes to a mitzvah, it's different. And you can understand that because a mitzvah is the king subordinating himself to the rule of Hashem. And that's the one place where the king has a right to subordinate himself. That's in the face of God. To other people, he can't do it. But when it comes to God, there he can wave his kavod, or there we can demand of him that he waves his kavod. So what Rebbe Yehuda will say is, the reason he can do this is because it's a mitzvah. And if you're following the mitzvah of Hashem, that's not a pagam in the dignity of the melech. The Baal Tosafot over here raised an issue that the Gemara in Ketubot says, if you come to a fork in the road, and you have two processions that are coming to the road. There's a procession of a king, and the other side is the procession of a kala or a chatan and kala. So who do you let go first? Do you let the chatan and kala go first? Because they are like king and queen, and you should give them deference to allow them to go first. Or do we say, no, it's the king. The king has to go first. So over there, the Gemara says that the king goes first, and he cannot wave his kavod in order to allow the chatan and kala to go by. So Tosafot says, based on the conclusion of our Gemara, why not? He's doing a mitzvah to give kavod to the chatan and kala, then mitzvah shiny, and he should be able to wave on his kavod in order to do that. So the Baal Tosafot answer, Yesh lomar dahatam in a mitzvah ki mishvil kavod ha-chatan ve-kala. Kavod ha-melech adif tvei mi kavod ha-chatan. The answer is that the mitzvah over there is to give honor to the chatan and kala. So now when you're dealing with the mitzvah that involves honor, over there, if you're trying to weigh between the honor of the king and the honor of the chatan and kala, the honor of the king will trump. But when it comes to a real mitzvah, when it's not just the honor of the king versus the honor of the chatan and kala, but rather it's the honor of God versus the honor of the king. In that case, the honor of God will trump, and therefore the king will be allowed to do the mitzvah, even if it's maybe beneath his dignity. Ve'en osim, you do not marry his wives. Tanya, amru lo the Rabbi Yehuda, nashim haruyot lo mi beit ha-melech. Rabbi Yehuda, in the Mishnah, it says a king is allowed to marry the widows of the previous king. So where does he know that from? He learns it out from the pasuk by Natan Navi. When he's chastising David for the chet bit, Bathsheba says, why did you do this? I gave you the kingship from your master Shaul, and I gave the wives of Shaul to you. So Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah learns from that a king is allowed to marry the widows of another king. So the Gemara says about that, Amalu lo Rabbi Yehuda, the Chachamim responded to Rabbi Yehuda as to why they disagree with this proof, to say, Nashim aruyut lo mi beit ha-melech. It says that they gave Nishe Adonecha, the wives of your master, meaning the wives of Shaul to you. It doesn't mean literally the wives of Shaul. It means that women from the royal palace or from the royal family that were given to David. Umayin and who? And who are they? Merav and Michal. Merav and Michal are two daughters of Shaul. And we're going to see in a second from the Pesukim and the Navi and the Agadata that David was either married to both of them or one of them at a time. So the answer of the Chachamim to Rabbi Yehuda is that the Nishe Adonecha does not refer to the wives or the widows of the king, but rather to other members of the royal family. Shalu Tamidav et Rabbi Yossi. Heyach nasa David shtei achayot b'chayehen. How did David marry two sisters in their lifetime? Had he married Merav and Michal, who were both daughters of Shaul? Amar lehen, Michal achar mitat Merav nasa. He only married Michal after Merav had passed away. Yeshua ben Karcho omer, kidushei ta'ot hayu lo b'merav. His marriage to Merav never took hold because the kiddushin were done by mistake or inappropriately, and therefore his marriage to Merav fell apart as if they were never married because it was never successful at establishing kiddushin because of the mistake that was made. Shenemar, David HaMelech says to Avner, when Avner is coming to tell him that maybe we can join together or maybe I can bring this 10 Shvatim to join you under your rulership of Yehuda. So David says as a prerequisite for any negotiations, he says that, Vayom etol v'anech rotit chabrit, I will form an alliance with you. Devar achar anech ushel mit chalemor. There's one thing that I ask from you. Lo tered panai, don't come and see me, David says to Avner, kim lifnei haviyachat Michal Bachul bo'achal rotet panai. Until you bring Michal Bachul, who is my wife, and you give her to me, that's the prerequisite for the negotiations. Says, Vayishlach David, el ishboshet ben Shaul emor, it's not ishti, et Michal asher rasti li b'mea harlot ishtim. Send me my wife, Michal, who I got married to after I fulfilled the requirement of me to appear with the 100 foreskins of the plishtim. Vayishlach Ishboshet vayikacha mimeish im paltiel ben laish. And so Ishboshet sends Michal bat Shaul to David HaMelech, takes her away from Palti ben laish, who seems to be married to her in the interim. Vayelech ita isha, halochu vacho acharei ad bachurim. And her husband followed after her all the way to the city of Bahurim. Paltiel ben Laish follows after Michal all the way into Bahurim as his wife is being taken away or leaving him to go to David HaMelech. Avner comes to tell Paltiel ben Laish, enough is enough, go back home, and he goes back home. So here the Gemara quotes the pasuk that we just read. The Gemara says, my Talmuda, what's the limud from this pasuk? Samarav Papa Michal Ishti Velo Merav Ishti. How does Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha know from this that Merav was Kedushei Ta'ut? Because the pasuk says, give me Michal, my wife, and they see that as being an exclusionary term. Michal, who's my wife, but not Merav, who's my wife. That implies that he was never married to Merav. My Kedushei Ta'ut. He was a mistaken Kiddushin, Dichtiv. Because it says by the battle with Goliath, that Shaul says, Vayayish asher yakenu, whoever kills Goliath, Yashrenu amelech osher gadol, he'll be enriched by the king. And the pasuk continues here, the Gemara puts in v'chule, but says that he will also be entitled to the daughter of the king. So Azal Katlein, David went ahead, and as we know in the story there, that David kills Goliath, and therefore he comes, in a sense, to claim his wife, or to claim the marriage that he was entitled to for killing Goliath. So Amarlo, so Shaul says to David, Milveh itlecha gabai. You have a loan with me. Ba'mikadesh v'milveh inu mikudeshet. If you try to create kiddushin through an indebtedness, inu mikudeshet, it does not succeed. So over here, the indebtedness seems to be the wealth or the money that was promised to David HaMelech by the king for whoever kills Goliath. And so there, David's claim against Shaul was for that money or for that outstanding debt that Shaul owed him. So now David wants to get married or was using that as the means of Kiddushin. It fails because he's being Mekadesh b'milveh. He's being Mekadesh through a loan. Azal yava v'adriel. So therefore Shaul went ahead, since he believed that David was not successfully married to his daughter Merav, he goes and gives her to Adriel. Dichtev v'hi v'eit Tate et Merav bat Shaul to David. The time when Shaul seemingly was going to give Merav, his daughter, to David, instead he gives her to Adriel. The pasuk is hard to read or hard to understand. You can see that even from the wording over here, which is, what does it mean that he was about to give her to David and then he gives her to Adriel? So what the Shunim say over there was that Be'et Tate, at the time period that was designated for Merav to be given to David, or at the point at which Shaul was obligated to give, instead of giving it to David, he gave it to Adriel. Amalei, Ibait, Deiten lecha Michal. He says, look, I have another daughter. Merav didn't work out, but I'll give you Michal. Zilaitili mea orlot plishtim. Go ahead and bring me back 100 foreskins of the plishtim. So now, in the Navi itself, it describes the motives behind Shaul's doing this. Shaul thinks that David's going to be killed, taken into captivity, or seriously wounded in a battle where he goes to take on the plishtim and bring out the foreskins. And that's Shaul's intent. He wants to rid himself of David. So he proposes this marriage proposal with Michal based on this very steep price of 100 foreskins of the plishtim. Aizel Aitile. So he went ahead and he did it. David is successful and brings it back. And now he wants to make his claim for Michal bat Shaul. So Shaul HaMelech says back to him, Milveh pruta itlecha. You now have two claims against me. You have one claim for the outstanding debt, and you have one claim for the pruta, the foreskins that you're turning over to me. Shaul believed, Milveh pruta, when you give a woman, you give her kiddushin through an outstanding loan, and you give her consideration through the foreskins, which are worth a pruta. In that case, datei al milveh. Shaul says is that the woman's mind is focused on the loan, and since that's the case, it wouldn't result in kiddushin. The David Savar, David believes, milveh pruta, datei apruta. When it comes to a loan and a pruta, then the woman's focus is on the pruta. And therefore, according to David, he was married to Michal. According to Shaul, he was not married to Michal. Viva itayma, tukuliyama, milveh pruta, datei apruta. Some suggest that this is the machloket. Everybody agrees that when you have a loan and a pruta, that the focus is on the pruta, and you would have a successful marriage. Shaul savar lo chazu velo mide. Shaul believed that the orlot were worthless, and therefore David did not have consideration by which to get married with. The David savar chazu the kalbe u lishunre, that they are ra'oi to feed to the dogs and the cats, and therefore they have some minimal value which will at least get to a pruta. So that's how Rabbi Yeshua ben Karka explains that the Kedushay Meirav were bita'ut, but the Kedushay Michal were effective. Because Kedushim b'milveh do fail as Kedushim, but Kedushim b'milveh pruta, we do paskin like David, that data la pruta. Because the machloku between Shaul and David is, when the woman is given these two items, what does she focus on? The milveh, which is the larger sum, which will fail as the consideration for the Kedushin, or the pruta, which is the smaller amount, but since it's here and tangible and can be given now, it actually effectuates the Kedushin. And so we paskin that a mekadesh b'milveh einu mikudeshet, but a mekadesh b'milveh pruta, data la pruta. For that reason, David's Kedushin with Merav were problematic, but his Kedushin with Michal were effective. And when it says, now, V'Rabbi Yossi, hi, t'nei et ishti et Michal, my dorish pei. Rabbi Yossi, who believes that David did not marry them simultaneously, but married them sequentially, that he first married Merav and then married Michal, which would imply that he was married to Merav. So then what does he do with the pasuk that says, t'nei et ishti et Michal bat Shaul? So Rabbi Yossi l'tamei, Rabbi Yossi l'shitato, d'tanya, Rabbi Yossi ayo doresh mikraot muravin. He used to darshan psukim that are intertwined. Ktiv, it says, v'yikach ha-melech et shnei b'nei ritzpa bataya, asher yalda l'sha'ul, v'et admoni, v'et mefiboshet, v'et chameshet b'nei michal, asher yalda l'adriel ha-mecholati. So over here you have a list of descendants of Sha'ul, who David HaMelech has to give over to the Givonim in order to placate the Givonim who have been wronged. David has to give over to the Givonim the remaining members or surviving members of Shaul's family. So over here you see a list of those individuals. The huge problem in the list is the fact that Asher Yaldat LaAdriel HaMcholati Me Michal Bat Shaul. Sounds like over here that we're talking about the children of Michal, the Chamesha B'nai Michal, the five sons or children of Michal, which she bore for Adriel. Well, wait a minute. We saw before in the Psukim that Adriel is the husband of Merav. So why all of a sudden now is he the husband of Michal? The second problem we have is that by the case where David was dancing up with the Aron, and Michal looked down upon that and thought that what he did was inappropriate, it says there that David is, that in the honor of Hashem, in the honor of the Aron, that I can do this, and I can lower my stature because it's the right thing to do in front of Hashem. And the Psukim say over there that Michal Bat Shaul never had children. So if she never had children, why is the Pasuk telling us over here that she has five sons? So, V'chi Adriel Natna? V'lo L'Paltiel Ben Laish Natna? What do you mean? She wasn't married to Adriel, she was married to Paltiel Ben Laish. That Shaul gave Michal, who was David's wife, to Palti ben Laish, not to Adriel. Ella mekish kedushei Merav laAdriel. So therefore, it connects between the kedushin of Merav to Adriel, the kedushei Michal the Palti, to the kedushin of Michal to Palti. Ma kedushei Michal the Palti ba'avera, just like the kedushin of Michal to Palti were in sin because she was really David's wife. And therefore it was inappropriate for her to be married to Palti. So too, or similarly, the marriage of Adriel to Merav was also flawed, because Merav was really married to David, and therefore Adriel couldn't marry her because she was really married to David. That's what he learns from those psukim, and that the connection between Michal Bat Shaul and Adriel is to focus on this idea that both marriages were problematic because David had preceded both marriages in marrying both Michal Bat Shaul and Merav Bat Shaul. And so according to Rabbi Yossi, he married both of them. Both marriages were successful, though it was done sequentially as to not be a problem of marrying two sisters in their lifetime. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha nami aktiv et chamesh b'nei Michal Bat Shaul. What is Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha going to do with the fact that the pasuk says that there were five sons of Michal Bat Shaul? Amar lecha Rabbi Yeshua, v'chi Michal yalda? Did Michal really give birth? V'alo Merav yalda? Weren't these the children of Merav? So my answer is yes. Merav yalda, u'Michal gibla. That Merav gave birth to them, but they were brought up by Michal. V'fikach nikru'u al shema. And therefore they were called by her name. V'medcha, to teach you, she called him a gadel yatom b'toch beito. Anybody brings up orphans in their house, male alam ha-katuv ki'ilu yalado. It's as if he gave birth to that individual. And therefore that will answer for us the position of Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, who says that this was kidushei ta'ut by Merav, He was never married to Mirab. He's married to Michal. And he'll explain the pasuk over here, not that David was married to Mirab and to Michal. No, he's only married to Michal. So what's the pasuk telling you about the fact that Michal is married to Adriel? It's teaching you that even though these were the children of her sister Mirab, after her sister Mirab passed away, Michal adopted the children. And since she adopted the children, she becomes as if she's the wife and mother of these children. She's as if she's filling into her sister's shoes, Mirab, to be the wife of Adriel and to be the parent or the mother to these children. And now it says, "V'chinin amar mehocha." You can learn that lesson out from here. But tikrena lo ashchenot shem lemor. The neighbors called the boy that was born the following name: Yulad ben Lenomi. That a son was born to Naomi. V'chin Naomi yolda. Does Naomi really give birth to a son? Halo Ruth yolda. It was Ruth's son, not Naomi's son. Ella Ruth yolda v'Naomi gidla. Ruth gave birth to her v'Naomi gidla, and Naomi brought him up. V'fikach nikra shema. Therefore, she was considered to be the parent of the child. Rabbi Yochanan amar mihocha. Yochanan says, you learn it out from here. I'll be honest with you, it's a very difficult and cryptic pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. It says, V'ishto ha-Yehudiya, his Jewish wife, Yalda et Yered, gave birth to Yered, v'et Avi Gedor. In the psukim there, it's two words, Avi Gedor. V'et Chever, Avi Socho, v'et Yekutiel, Avi Zanoach, v'ele bnei bitya bat paro, ashelakach mored. So that's the pasuk that we're quoting over here. So now, who are these the children of? Ele bnei bitya bat paro, ashelakach Mared. Mared ze Kalev. Mared, the name there is synonymous with Kalev, who's mentioned in a couple of psukim beforehand, although it's hard really to see the connection between Kalev, who's mentioned earlier, and the Mered that's mentioned in this pasuk, because Zalav and Masora, that they are the same individual. V'lama yikra shmo Mared. So why was his name called Mared, or really Mered? Shemarad biatzat miraglim. Because he rebelled against towing the line with the miraglim. And he argues on the Merglim, trying to convince the people that it's worthwhile to go into Eretz Yisrael, and they shouldn't listen to the report of the Merglim. Did Bitya really give birth to him? Over there in the Pasuk, the names of the individuals that were born, it says are Ishta Yehudiya Yaldat Yered, Avi Gedor. And what Rashi points out over here, though, these were alternate names for Moshe Rabbeinu. This suggests that Bitya was the mother of Moshe Rabbeinu. Valo Yacheved Yaldat. What do you mean? Bitya bat Paro did not give birth to Moshe Rabbeinu. Yocheved was the mother of Moshe Rabbeinu. Ela Yocheved Yalada, Ubitya Gidla. Yocheved gave birth to Moshe, but Moshe was brought up in the palace of Paro by the daughter of Paro, the Fikach Nikra Shema. Therefore, she's credited with being the parent of the child. Rabbi Elazar Amar Mihalcha, Rabbi Elazar says you can learn from here. Ge'alta bizroa amecha bnei Yaakov Yosef Sela. That you will redeem with your outstretched or your strong arm your nation, bnei Yaakov Yosef, the children of Yaakov and Yosef. V'chi Yosef Yalat. What do you mean? Yosef's not the one who gave birth to the Shvatim and to Klal Yisrael. Hello, Yaakov Yalat. Isn't Yaakov the patriarch of the family? So then why is it mentioning Yosef? Ela Yaakov Yalat Yosef Kilkel. Yaakov produced the family. He was the patriarch of the family. But when they came down to Mitzrayim, they were sustained by Yosef. L'chichach nikru al shemo. And therefore they were called by his name. They attribute the masses of Klal Yisrael not only to Yaakov, but also to Yosef. Amar Rabbi Shmo bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, kol ha-melameid ben chaviro Torah, male alav ha-katuv ki'il yaldo. That if a person teaches his friend's son Torah, it's as if it's his son. Shneamar ve'ele toldot Aron Moshe. It says in Bamidbar that now they're coming to enumerate the toldot, the descendants of Moshe and Aaron. Uchtev, and it says ve'ele shmot bnei Aaron. And then right afterwards, it just gives you the names of the children of Aaron. But what's not there are the names of the children of Moshe. Lomalachas, that comes to teach you Aaron yalat uMoshe limed. Aaron gave birth to them, but Moshe taught them Torah. V'fikach nikru ashamo. And therefore, they're connected to his name. So now, if you look back over all these limudim, you see actually a progression in the limudim about when person's given credit for bringing up a child. In the first instance, Michal took over completely for her sister Merav, and therefore she's credited with bringing up the child. All the way to here in the end, where Moshe Rabbeinu simply taught his brother's children, and therefore is giving credit as if he gave birth to his children or raised those children. So you see here a progression that each one of the proofs actually takes you further away from being a step-parent or really responsible for the bringing up of the child. Nevertheless, you're still giving credit as if you brought up this child or gave birth to this child. This is what Hashem says to Beit Yaakov, who redeemed Avraham. So it sounds like that Beit Yaakov were the ones that redeemed Avraham. Where do we find the fact that Yaakov redeemed Avraham? He saved them from the difficulty of having to raise children. The way that Rashi reads it is Tzar Gidul Banim has to do with the 12 Shvatim that Yaakov had, was responsible for all 12 of the Shvatim, and therefore he had much more to manage than Avram Avinu, and so he spared Avram Avinu by being the one that had the Shvatim, that Avram Avinu didn't have to go through all those troubles and tribulations. The Baal HaTosafot do not like that answer. They reject that answer for two reasons, one of which is that Avram himself had 8 children, and therefore you can't say Tzar Gidul Banim as opposed to Avraham. And in addition, Baal HaTosafot show that by Oved Edomi and other situations in the Tanakh, that more children are considered a brocha and not a problem. Baal HaTosafot answer, Mitzareich Lomar, Tzar Shel Yosef Echav V'Gilgul Yiridat Mitzrayim. It wasn't the Tzar Gidul Banim, bring up the children, but the Tzar that was particular to this aspect of Yaakov, which is the fighting between Yosef and the brothers, as well as the fact that they end up having to go down to Mitzrayim, or you read that Mitzrayim. So that's the Tzar Gidul Banim of here. That's what it meant in the Pasuk in Yishayahu. Lo ata yevosh, Yaakov. Now you will not be ashamed, Yaakov. Lo ata yevosh, Yaakov, me'aviv. Not now will you be ashamed, Yaakov, from your father. Lo ata panav yechevaru, and your face will not turn pale, me'avi aviv, from his grandfather. So Yaakov, in the end, took on the burdens that were incumbent upon Yitzchak, his father, and Avraham, his grandfather. Therefore, he won't be ashamed to be in front of them because he carried out the promise that Hashem had made through his Tzar Gidul Banim. Div Palti, Uchtiv Paltiel. At the end of Shmuel Aleph, it says that Shaul gave Michal Bat Shaul to Palti Ben Laish. But later on, when we read the Psukim in Shmuel Bet, where David insists on the return of Michal, there it says, Paltiel ben Laish. So why does he have two different names? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Palti Shemo, his real name is Palti. Lamni Kra Shmo Paltiel. So then why does he have this name Paltiel? Shepelato Kel Min Aveira. The God saved him or extracted him from sin. Ma Asa, Na'at Scherev Beino Lebeina. Palti ben Laish stuck a sword between him and Michal Bat Shaul. Amar Kolo Osek B'Davar Zeh Yidaker B'Cherev Zeh. Anybody who engages in relations will be stabbed or punctured by this. In essence, what he did was, he was living with his wife, but not in physical contact, but separate from his wife with a sword between them. Obviously then, that Palti ben Laish knew there was a problem with Shaul's giving him of Michal, and therefore, he didn't want to be Over Aveira or a problem of Eshet Ish. So he stuck a sword there and didn't allow himself to consummate the marriage with Michal Bat Shaul. Vachtiv, doesn't it say in the beginning of Shmuel Bet, when David asks Avner for the return of Michal Bat Shaul, says, Vayelech ita isha, her husband follows behind. The Pasuk says, oto isha, her husband. If it says in the Pasuk, her husband, that means that they were married. The Pasuk says, no, shenasela ki isha. Not that they were literally married, because luckily it was not successful. But she was acting or in the position of being like a wife, because he loved her and cared for her like a wife. Vativ, halochu vachol, doesn't it say that he was crying? That he was falling behind her and bawling? If she was just ki'isha, then I don't think he would have been in that emotional state. If it's really his wife, then it makes sense why he's in such a difficult emotional state. It says, ad'a l'mitzvah d'azlaminei. The reason that he was crying was not because of losing Michal Bat Shaul, but because he's losing the mitzvah that he did all that time. Ad Bachurim, Palti ben Laish, or Paltiel ben Laish follows Michal all the way to Bachurim. Shana Asushnehem ki Bachurim. They were both like youngsters. Shlo Tamu Tambia. Because they never had relations with each other. Again, this is perpetuating what the Chachamim just said before, that Palti ben Laish, even though he's granted Michal Bat Shaul by Shaul, does not believe that she is really available to him. And therefore, takes precautions not to really marry her or not to really consummate the marriage with her. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, tokfo shel Yosef, what was a great challenge for Yosef, anvatanuto shel Boaz, was a little sneeze for Boaz. Tokfo shel Boaz, what was so difficult for Boaz, anvatanuto shel Palti ben Laish, was a small issue for Palti ben Laish. Tokfo shel Yosef, when it comes to the heroism of Yosef and his salvation from the hands of his master's wife, which was a huge deal in Yosef's life, but it's a small thing in the life of Boaz, Dichtiv. It was in the middle of the night. The man was trembling. He was frightened by the fact that there was someone in his bed right now. So the Pasuk then says the verb, which is a very unclear word. The Mefarshim there say that means to rub or hold on to embrace in some senses, or to shake. And that's what it means here, Vayilafet. Here, Boaz is reaching down to feel who's there or what's there in his bed. But here the Gemara darshens on that. My vilafet. What does it mean, vilafet? What does that verb mean? Amar Rav Naseb Saro Kiroshe Liftot. His skin became like the heads of turnips, meaning that it hardened, or he was scared of the situation, the circumstance that he found himself in. While others suggest that it's really a euphemism for his becoming overcome with desire. But nevertheless, despite the fact that there's a woman sleeping in his bed, Boaz never takes advantage of that situation. Tokfo shel Boaz, that which is heroic of Boaz, amvantanuto shel Palti ben Laish, was a no big deal for Palti ben Laish. Kidamran, like we said before, which is that, before we said that, Palti ben Laish lived with Michal bat Shaul for many years, and never took advantage of her, and never had relations with her. Whereas Boaz, we're speaking about a very short period of time, that one night, and therefore whatever his big deal was for Palti ben Laish, that was no big deal, because Palti ben Laish did this over an extended period of time. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, my dichtiv, what's meant in the pasuk? Rabot banut osuchayo, ve'at alit al kulana. Many women have been successful and made a good name for themselves. Vatalita kulana, but you are better than any of them, or you're on top of all of them. Rabot banot asuchayo, ze Yosef u Boaz. Or they were very successful. That refers to Yosef and Boaz. Vatalita kulana, ze Palti ben Laish. That refers to Palti ben Laish. So Yosef and Boaz, asuchayo, they were good, they were excellent. But who is the pinnacle? That's Palti ben Laish. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Ma'idichtiv. What's meant in the pasuk? Sheker achein v'hevel ayofi. Grace is a falsehood, and beauty is meaningless. Sheker achein, that refers to Yosef. V'hevel ayofi ze Boaz. Irat Hashem hititalau ze Palti ben Laish. Again, a similar genre of drasha and midrash, whereby we are, in some senses, diminishing the greatness of Boaz and Yosef, because they pale in comparison to what Palti ben Laish did. Tavar acher, sheker achein behevel ayofi, sheker achein zed doro shel Moshe, behevel ayofi zed doro shel Yoshua, yirat Hashem hititalau zed doro shel Chizkiah. Here we're referencing to the learning of Torah, and so the doro to Moshe and Yoshua, who were many of them at the foot of Har Sinai. About them, the pasuk says, Sheker Achein, Vehevel Ayofi, the door of Moshe, and the door of Yeshua, in terms of learning, accomplishments, and the amount of learning that was going on, they were nothing compared to the generation of Chizkiyahu, which the Gemara relates about Chizkiyahu, that they sent from one end of the land to the other end of the land, and they couldn't find an Amaretz, because there was so much schooling and learning of Torah, that everybody was considered to be knowledgeable. Davar acher, another interpretation of this, Sheker achein zed doro shel Moshe v'Yoshua. That's the generation of Moshe and Yoshua. V'hevel ayofi zed doro shel Chizkiyahu. Irat Hashem hititalau zed doro shel Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Elai. That's the generation of Yehuda bar Elai. Amru alav Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Elai she'ayu shisha talmidim mitkasim mitalit echad v'oskim b'Torah. That they were so poor, so impoverished in the day of Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Elai, that he had six students that were covered in a single talit, in a single cloak, voskim b'Torah, and they were engaged in Torah. So you see here that the Gemara is dismissing the generation of Moshe, generation of Yoshua, even the generation of Chizkiyahu, despite all their greatness in Torah and all their knowledge in Torah, Even despite all that, there was still someone greater, which is the generation of Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Eli, despite tremendous poverty, how much they learned. It teaches you how they were able to get along with each other, that six of them would be in a single talit and not complain about it, and not have altercations between them. So that shows you the greatness of the door of Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Eli, that even exceeded the door of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, which is renowned for its Torah erudition, as well as the door of Moshe and Yeshua, which are obvious as being renowned for being knowledgeable in Torah. And I just mention here the interpretation of the Gra with regards to Sheker Achein Ve'Evel Ayofi Isha Yirat Hashem Hititalau. So if you read the pasuk, or the way that most people read the pasuk is Sheker Achein Ve'Evel Ayofi, toss them out, they're meaningless. Yirat Hashem Hititalau, that's the only midah, that's the only thing that matters. On the other hand, the Gra says that's not the right way to read it, but rather Sheker Achein Ve'Evel Ayofi. When is Sheker Achein Ve'Evel Ayofi? That's when you're lacking Yirat Hashem. But if you have Yirat Hashem Hititalau, then the Chain and the Yofi are worth something. What we're saying is that not to disregard or discard Chain and Yofi completely and say that they should be replaced with Yirat Hashem, but rather it should mean that the Yirat Hashem enhances the Chain and the Yofi, makes the Yofi even more beautiful and the Chain even more Chainadik. And so that's where the Gra explains this pasuk of Shekhar Chayin, Ve'evel Ayofi Yirat Hashem Hititalau, not to look at it as being mutually exclusive, but rather to look at it as that Yirat Hashem Hititalau colors everything, gives you perspective, and allows the elevation of even what seemingly are mundane matters of Chayin and Yofi. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Chof Amud Aleph.